It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the pandemic caused big disruptions for farmers, especially early on, and that pushed some states to help them sell their products directly to customers online. We'll hear more about the idea from Politico's food and agriculture reporter. First, after a year and a half of pandemic life, it's starting to feel like the hardest time to make a decision about anything, pandemic-related or not, is right now. Why is that? It could be that many of us are experiencing what's called decision fatigue. We're tired not only of making choices, but also just thinking about the choices we have to make. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this sound familiar to you? Are you struggling to make decisions lately, over the last year and a half or so? Are we overwhelmed by choices sometimes in our modern world? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's just one decision. It's an easy one. Barry Schwartz is Emeritus Professor of Psychology at Swarthmore College and Visiting Professor at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of several books, including The Paradox of Choice. Barry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be with you, Rob.
What is decision fatigue?
Well, decision fatigue is the idea that as we make choices, it's taxing to make choices. And if you make one choice after another, you get tired. It's sort of like lifting weights, and eventually you can't do another rep. Well, you know, you keep making decisions and you can't do another rep. That's what it is.
I have an example of this when I first started hosting this show. Actually, there was a lot of thinking, a lot of decision making. And then when I'd go to a restaurant, say with my family after, and I'd look at the menu, it was too much. I couldn't make another decision. Somehow I settled into that. I mean, is that what's going on there, this decision fatigue? You just hit a breaking point?
I think so. And, you know, so there are several possible results of that. One is that you don't make a decision. You just you're paralyzed.
I hand the menu to my wife in that scenario, yes.
Or you just listen to what other people order, and then you pick one of those, and you're down from 20 options to the three of the people who ordered before you. Another is that you do make a decision, but because you're not thinking as well as you might, you make a bad decision. And we know that that happens, especially when it's a complicated decision. You simplify it, and sometimes you do it at a price. And the last thing is you manage to make a decision, and you manage to make a good decision, but you're not satisfied with it. You're sure that somehow you made a mistake, that you left a better option on the table. So it's really a mess. And I think the pandemic has really heightened the problem. I mean, this is a problem with modern rich societies, period. Choice fatigue. The book I wrote, The Paradox of Choice, I wrote almost 20 years ago, and we were overwhelmed with options then. It's worse now. But the pandemic has really introduced a new level of complexity to life that I think is wearing people out.
Yeah, can you talk about that new layer of decisions we have to make, not just the daily ones already on our plate, but can I do my daily thing safely? Mask here, mask not there, vaccination, should I go here, not there? How much does that add to our choice plate here?
Well, I think enormously, and especially because these are high stakes, many of them feel like high stakes decisions. So, you know, back pre-pandemic, most of the things we did during the day, we essentially did on automatic pilot. You know, yes, in some sense, it was a decision what cereal to have for breakfast, but it was a decision that you essentially made automatically. Much of our life was run that way. Then the pandemic comes and nothing's automatic anymore. Everything is different. But it was so frightening, and the rules that were handed down were so strict that even though we were terrified, we didn't have a whole lot of options about how we lived our life. You know, everything was closed. So, yes, we were scared, but we were not suffering from decision fatigue. Then things start to get better, and people start to get vaccinated, and things open up a little bit. And now, all of a sudden, it's, do I go into work or do I work from home? Do I send my kids to school or don't I send my kids to school? Do I go out to dinner with friends, or is that too risky? If I go out to dinner with friends, am I willing to eat inside, or do I insist on eating outside? These are all new decisions we never had to make before, and they're very potentially very consequential. And I think it really has us all running around like we've lost our minds.
Talking to Barry Schwartz, he's the author of books, including The Paradox of Choice. We're talking about decision fatigue, a thing that was already there. The pandemic, he says, add a lot more decisions, a lot more gray areas and choices in our lives. It builds up. It is draining, fatiguing, and can lead to bad choices sometimes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about decision fatigue? An example of how it's affected your own life maybe this week? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Barry, are there ways, if we're feeling this kind of overload of decisions, are there ways we can help deal with it, cut out maybe some of the more routine decisions so we can set our focus on the most important stuff?
I think the answer is yes, but in my experience, it isn't easy to do these things. That is, the world is tempting us not to do what I'm about to suggest. One thing is to take advantage of what's habitual and routine in life. Instead of rejecting routine, embrace routine so that the number of actual decisions that you have to think about during the day is reduced. And again, as I said, that's what made COVID such a challenge. Most of those routines just exploded. So nothing seemed routine. Another thing you can do is to have a criterion when you're making a decision that what you're looking for is good enough. You don't need the best. Good enough will do. And what that does is it simplifies decisions because you don't have to look at all the options. You just have to look at options until you find one that meets your standards, and then you stop looking. And, you know, think about Netflix. How many movies can you choose from on Netflix? A million? I don't know.
Lots.
And, you know, there's a lot of people, and this has happened to me any number of times. Let's watch a movie tonight. Let's see what Netflix has to offer. You spend an hour searching and you end up watching a rerun of something you've already seen because it's just impossible to pull the trigger. Or you do pull the trigger and you're sitting there as this movie unfolds thinking, oh, I bet there was a better one that I passed up. And the result is, you know, either no decisions or dissatisfaction with decisions. And again, what the pandemic did is it pushed us online all the time instead of only some of the time. And the number of options you face online is essentially infinite. And no matter how big the store is, the actual store, it's not infinite. But Netflix is effectively infinite, and Amazon is effectively infinite. And if that's all of your interaction with the world is on platforms like that, it's easy to see how you'd want to just dig a hole and climb in.
How do we turn off the part of our brain that's evaluating? I guess it's an opportunity cost. I'm watching this movie, but I could be watching a better movie or reading a great book, or I could marry this person and be happy, but maybe there's somebody better out there. Like any decision we make, how do we say, yeah, this one's good enough?
Let me tell you something. If I knew the answer to that question, I wouldn't be talking to you. the temptation to visit the roads not taken is incredibly strong. And it's not always bad. I mean, one way we learn to correct mistakes is by paying attention to roads not taken so that the next time when the options face us, we'll make a different choice. That's a good thing. But the trick is to have some control over it so that it's not always kicking in, and it's not kicking in no matter how satisfying and good the choice you actually made was. It's really, really hard not to be thinking about the alternatives. And then you do a number on yourself and convince yourself that the alternatives would have been better. Any little thing that's disappointing about what you've chosen, and you're just convinced that you've blown an opportunity to have a perfect experience.
We're talking to Barry Schwartz, Emeritus Professor of Psychology at Swarthmore College, visiting professor at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. He's written a lot of books, including, most relevant to our conversation today, The Paradox of Choice. We're talking about this idea of decision fatigue, where we have to keep making decisions, could be overwhelmed by them after a while. worse during the pandemic? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an example of this happening to you? Does this happen routinely after a tough day, say at work or of childcare or at school, and you hit a decision-making wall where you can't do it anymore, or you're paralyzed by the next choice that comes along? Do you have a question about how all this works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Barry Schwartz, Emeritus Professor of Psychology at Swarthmore College, author of books including The Paradox of Choice. And we're talking about what's called decision fatigue and why you may be experiencing it, A, in the modern world, B, more so during the pandemic with an extra layer of safety and health decisions on top of the usual mix. You can join in. Is that you? At 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to make a lot of things more routine? So when you got to make a decision, it's on the important stuff. Do you have questions about decision fatigue? Do you hit a wall sometimes after a day of many decisions? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Ellen is with us on the road. Ellen, hi.
Hi there. So I'm having a little difficulty understanding the issue because I don't think I'm having that issue. I did find the experience of, you know, having to not be out all the time and doing stuff all the time rather freeing. And so I didn't have to care about the decisions I made. And even now, maybe I got so comfortable with making the decision not to go places that I'm very, I don't know if this is the right word, conservative in the decisions I do make to go. But I'm also maybe somebody who doesn't live with regrets. So when I do make a decision, it's like, okay, well, I experienced that and, you know, I learned something.
I gotcha, Ellen. And Barry, it sounds like, Ellen, you said earlier, early in the pandemic, in some ways, some decisions were off the plate. I can't go to a restaurant, so that's a decision I don't have to make. Ellen seems like took that and ran with it and settled into kind of a new routine in some ways.
It sounds like it. And you know, all I can say is hats off to Ellen. It's hard to do that. And it's especially hard to do that when you're, I think, when you're making decisions not only for yourself, but for other people. You know, like, you know, family members. And there are trade-offs involved with keeping your kids maximally safe versus giving them the best educational experience they can have. So if Ellen, you know, there's no question when the pandemic hit, the world of options was dramatically shrunk for most people. And the question is what happens when the world started to open up? And what I'm suggesting is that at least for some people, that took the already complicated world of decisions that we had pre-pandemic and added a whole new set of decisions for us. Apparently that didn't happen with Ellen, but let me just say, she said one key thing. She said she's not somebody who worries much about regret. Mm. That is a crucial, crucial piece of mental health. if you don't worry much about regretting decisions, then there's less pressure on you to make sure you're making the best decision. You know, you make a decision, you make the best of it, and tomorrow is another day. So not only missed opportunities, but regret really, really poison us. And Ellen seems to have taken the magic no regret pill.
Ellen, well done.
You should market it, Ellen.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Ellen, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Cindy on the line in Bear Valley. Cindy, hi.
Hi. Hey, I don't think I have decision fatigue, but every time I go to the grocery store, after choosing all my things, and then they ask me, do I want plastic or paper bag?
Yeah.
That one always throws me, and I don't care. I can't make that decision.
Well, and is it different, Cindy? Because I know I go grocery shopping. I do most of our shopping. And that question comes up after I've made lots of decisions, red beans or black beans or this or that.
Right.
It's at the end. It's the last decision to make, right? Is that part of the problem?
Maybe that's that's part of the problem, and it's a small problem.
Well, sure. Sure, and maybe just go in with the plan. I don't know. What do you think, Barry?
Well, I just have to, Cindy, I certainly resonate with this, but there's a wonderful cartoon that appeared in the New Yorker some years ago. A guy is about to have his head chopped off in a guillotine.
Oh, no.
And the executioner is standing over the guy, and the caption reads, and he's holding a bag, and the caption reads, paper or plastic. Do you want your head to go into a paper bag or a plastic bag? And it's, you're right. It's like, you know, I've just spent an hour torturing myself, and now I thought I was escaping, but no, you're giving me one more decision to make, and I don't care. And, you know, they won't let you say I don't care. They insist that you
actually make
a choice.
Yeah. Cindy, thank you so much. Maybe just pick one before you go into the store. I don't know. Let's go to Kay now in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I find that I can make a decision sometimes, like, for example, going back to the senior center since they reopened. But my friends or my relatives will question my judgment and say, we don't think you should go because of COVID, you know. And then I said, well, if I don't go, I'll get really depressed, because all my friends are there and I'm wearing a mask. And so I don't know if that happens to other people or not, but being judged.
I bet it does, Kay. Thank you so much. And that's a great example, Barry. Another layer of these safety decisions we have to make, but also just about any decision you make, there's going to be somebody to argue with you about it. Is that another layer of what's leading to our decision fatigue?
You know, I think it is. And there's been a lot of attention paid in the last couple of weeks about the damage that Facebook is doing to people, especially to young girls. And I think a little piece of that is that when you're on Facebook, you're being judged. You're being judged all the time, and you take that judgment with you. You know, when you go to bed at night, you have your phone next to you, which means you have all these judges next to you. And it's very hard to turn those judgments off. So I hear what Cindy is saying as a, you know, that's a problem with modern life. The more public our choices are, the more the world gets to find out about them, the more I think we worry, not just about what will be best for us, but what other people will think we should have chosen. So you've got this voice whispering in your head about what the world's going to think of you after you make this choice. And that makes even relatively trivial choices feel less trivial. So I think Cindy's onto something. And let me also say one other thing. The three callers you've gotten, I could be wrong about this, but they sounded like they're not kids. And I think the problem of choice fatigue is much worse for young people than it is for older people, because we really do have a set of routines that it would take almost dynamite to get us to give up. And so we manage the choice world much better than young people do. They hate the idea of doing anything out of habit. They welcome with open arms the opportunities to do new things. And I think they are the ones who are paying the heaviest price for the choice explosion.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Barry Schwartz about decision fatigue. He's the author of books, including The Paradox of Choice. Barry, my restaurant example earlier, if I get the wrong meal, who cares? But what about decision fatigue for somebody in a high stakes situation, if they're flying a plane or performing surgery? Are there strategies, are there, I don't know, routines that we have for people to make sure that in that important moment, they're not overwhelmed by decision fatigue?
Well, I think here too, it's mostly habit. You know, you get into, we talk about athletes getting into a zone. And I have a feeling that for a lot of people who do high pressure, high skilled work, what saves them is that they get into a zone. And a lot of stuff that they have to do gets run off essentially automatically because they are so well practiced at it. You know, concert musicians are not making a decision about before they hit a piano key. They're there's a whole like string of responses that are so well practiced by them that they can essentially run off automatically. So I think that's what saves us. Now, the question of, before you start your surgical procedure, do doctors have a problem that there are now, let's say, 8 different ways to approach this particular illness instead of only 2? I bet they do have a problem. I bet they do. But the problem happens offline. You know, they solve it before they actually go into the operating room. But I think they are faced now with I think less with surgery probably than with drugs. There are so many drugs available to treat the same disease. I think it's a major, major problem for physicians to decide what course of treatment is the best course of treatment for this patient.
Barry, here's a weird thing. Maybe this is just me. When I feel this decision fatigue setting in, sometimes I feel like sugary and or fatty food is going to help me through the candy bar or whatever. Is this magical thinking by Rob, or is there some kind of like nutritional component thing going on?
Well, so this turns out you've put your finger on an extremely controversial research line of research in psychology. I won't mention any names, but there was a suggestion that choosing basically fatigues our self-control. It takes self-control to make decisions, and it gets fatigued, and the result is that you have a harder time resisting temptation. And one of the arguments that people who are doing this work has made is you can boost people's self-control and overcome fatigue by giving them sugar. So, you know, you have people do something that's very demanding, their self-control is waning, and they drink a cup of apple juice, and all of a sudden they're in charge of themselves and their decisions again. This, as I say, is highly controversial, so I wouldn't take this particular result to the bank, but it sounds to me, Rob, like you're effectively endorsing that theory by eating a candy bar.
To be fair, I like candy bars and donuts. So
the worst that happens is you know, you may still be terrible at making decisions, but you've just had a delicious candy bar.
All right, Barry, that's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a pleasure.
That's Barry Schwartz, Emeritus Professor of Psychology at Swarthmore College, author of books including The Paradox of Choice. He joined us to talk about decision fatigue during the pandemic. So time for you to share your stories, if you'd like, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, the early months of the pandemic shook up agricultural markets, leading a lot of farmers to explore selling their products online and or direct to consumers. A farm reporter tells us how some farmers are making direct sales a part of their regular operations now and into the future. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, from ransomware to identity theft to national security threats, get a roundup of the biggest news in the world of cybersecurity. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, when schools and restaurants shut down at the start of the pandemic, a lot of farmers had no one to buy their products. Some had to dump their milk, others had to toss or donate produce. Some states, though, like Florida and Maine, had a strategy aimed at helping, a website that would let farmers sell their products online to more local customers, an effort that one state official called an online farmers market. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you buy products directly from farmers at a farm stand, farmers market, or CSA? If you're a farmer, did the pandemic interfere with your regular sales? Do you sell direct to consumers one way or another? What do you think of this idea of an online farmer's market, a matchmaking service between farmers and local customers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Ximena Bustillo is a food and agriculture policy reporter at Politico. She's also the author of the Morning Agriculture newsletter. Ximena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, can you take us back to those disruptions at the beginning of the pandemic for those farmers used to selling lots of stuff to big customers like schools and restaurants?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you noted, know, schools and entertainment venues all closed, you know, almost at around the same time in a couple weeks time frame in March and early April. And the key thing to kind of note is that the packaging for what is called fresh produce, so what you find in a school lunch cafeteria or at a restaurant, is different than packaging that you find at the grocery store, where you can get an individual package of flour or individually wrapped beef even. For schools, for restaurants, it's all bulk packaging. And that was one of the first issues that producers and farmers saw, was trying to figure out how to pivot. We heard that word a lot, how to pivot their supply chain from bulk to individual or from individual to bulk, one way or another. And, you know, people and companies just weren't buying that bulk at the same rate, which means that you had producers with all this food ready to pick, ready to process, with literally nowhere to go. And then you had issues at meatpacking plants, where workers, many who are undocumented or lacked access to PPE or time off, were getting sick at record rates, and that slowed the meat processing plants. So at the end of the day, there was never a complete shortage of food in existence within the country, but there were backlogs and bottlenecks in the supply chain. And that's why you hear the term supply chain disruptions or bottlenecks or issues kind of coming from there.
Now, we're familiar with this happening with milk, certainly here in Wisconsin. You keyed in on tomatoes in Florida for one of your examples, and talked to some tomato farmers there whose, you know, usual MO would be, we're growing lots of tomatoes and we're selling them all over the country. What did you hear from them about those early days?
Yeah, absolutely. I talked to one particular producer to start. His name's Tony DeMari, and he is a large producer in Florida. He also actually has two operations in California. So really, really large like production and farms for tomatoes, like millions of pounds. And when the pandemic hit Florida, the interesting thing there is it was their peak harvest season. And much of the food either goes to those same fresh avenues, especially entertainment venues like theme parks, or it's exported out to other states. So even if Florida didn't shut down or see as big of closures as other states did, it did affect whether or not food could even leave that state to begin with. So producers like Tony were like, we do not have anywhere to go. And even if they did donate to food banks didn't have often the personnel levels or even the capacity to take as much food as they normally, as was being kind of funneled towards them. And when it comes to dairy production, dairy products, even like cheese, right? Like think of a bulk, you know, thing of cheese that's very, very large. A food bank isn't going to be able to just take that.
Talking to Ximena Bustillo from Politico. She's an agriculture reporter there, looking at the disruptions from the early days of the pandemic and the ways that farmers and some states tried to help people used to selling to big customers, as we've been talking about, to sell to local consumers instead. You can join at 800-642-1234. Is this a familiar story to you, maybe, as a farmer? That's 800-642-1234. As a customer, do you look for ways to buy as direct as possible from farmers? Is it easier said than done sometimes in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Okay, Ximena, there's this big problem out there. You found a couple of states that tried to help connect the dots here. Could you tell us what they tried to do?
Yeah, so I zeroed in on Florida and Maine, as you mentioned earlier. Florida, from the get-go, created a brand new website called Florida Farms to You. And it was kind of this matchmaking service where producers could upload a profile with what they sell, when it'll expire, where they're located. And then people or companies could go on there and just literally see where they could go and show up and order, you know, direct to consumer there. In Maine, Maine already had something like this, which is pretty interesting. Like they already knew that supply chain disruptions could potentially be a problem, largely because unlike Florida, which is at the start of the supply chain line, Maine tends to be the end. But also similarly, like a lot of the food that they produce within the state leaves the state. It doesn't stay inside the state. So they wanted to find a way already that if there were supply chain disruptions, how could they, you know, preempt that and have that consumer base inside. The thing that they did differently is they had additional grants, you know, for producers to spend money on credit card fees if they needed those, or website domains if they needed to make those, or purchase new equipment to do that pivot that we were talking about earlier and buy new equipment to be able to package things differently or process food differently for an individual consumer base. And that did allow some producers to really increase their consumer base by extreme amounts and really, really profit instead from the pandemic. Obviously, we didn't see that everywhere across the country. Not all producers had access to these resources. Not everyone necessarily knew about them. And not everyone can always afford to order their food directly through a farmer or a producer. And so there are some caveats there. But the fact that it worked in some areas is indicative that if this was maybe expanded more or more resources were poured into that, it could really work.
Right. In Florida, you mentioned they had the online matchmaking service to help farmers sell directly to consumers. But without some of those things you mentioned in Maine, if I understand this right, like going from selling lots of stuff to big customers to small amounts of stuff to a whole bunch of different customers, there's a lot of logistical hurdles there. And the things like you mentioned in Maine, the credit card processing, the packaging, things like that. Did that make a difference in Florida?
That's a really good question. I think it really just depends. And even in Maine, it really just depended on if you had access to the information, if you knew that the state were running these programs to begin with. I did talk to some producers that said that they didn't know that this was even an option for them. But I also talked to some that said that they did know that it was an option, and they were able to work with the state and work with the website to find, you know, even as much as volunteer truck drivers that just they had a truck that could refrigerate food and transport their goods. So, you know, it's a very like interesting collaborative and community effort almost to a sense.
Talking to Ximena Bustillo, she covers food and agriculture policy at Politico. She's the author of the Morning Agriculture newsletter there. With us today to talk about her recent reporting on a couple of state-run websites that let farmers sell their products online, partly a response to supply chain disruptions early in the pandemic. As we'll find out coming up, some of those farmers like having a wider customer base. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As someone who eats food, I imagine you do. Do you look for ways to get stuff directly as possible from your local farmers, whether that's going up to the farm stand, the farmer's market, maybe a CSA? What do you like about that if you do it? Do you wish you had more opportunities to do it? If you are on the farming side of things, is this something you've been working on for a long time, having a wider customer base by selling direct to consumers? What challenges, if so, have you run into? And were you one of the many farmers, especially dairy farmers in Wisconsin, who ran into trouble when a lot of big customers were shut down for a while? How did it all work out for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can share your story or question. Email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk now about some of the latest agriculture news, including reporting from our guest about ways that farmers around the country have tried to reach out and sell more directly to consumers. Coming in part out of the disruption from the early days of the pandemic, some states set up online matchmaking, a farmer's market type arrangements to help them do that. Still time for your calls, your experiences buying directly from farmers. If you're a farmer trying to sell directly to consumers, what works? What doesn't? Is it something you're looking to do more of in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ximena, a lot of farmers did this. They tried to get into selling direct to consumers. Is this just something, an emergency thing that they did for a while? Or did you find some of them who say, yeah, we're going to try to keep doing this?
I think a lot of them really liked it, you know, just having that revenue option and building that loyal consumer base was something that a lot of them really enjoyed. And this, you have to keep in mind that this also comes along with an increasing trend of people in the United States in general wanting to buy more local and wanting to know where their food comes from. This has been happening incrementally for about 9 years. In 2018, a Gallup poll found that nearly 75% of Americans said that they were trying to include more locally grown foods in their diets, including vegetables, fruits, chicken. So this is something the American consumer is really kind of wanting to see. And when we've seen this trend kind of happening over time. So I just think that it's a whole new consumer base that the pandemic almost like supercharged and like sped up the timeline for.
I just wonder about scale here. If I'm going from selling to Disney World or the Milwaukee School District Food Service or something to Bob over there and Jane over there, like, does the scale really match up? Does it make up for that? Did it make up for that lost business, especially early on?
That is a really good question, and probably not. You know, if you sell to a cruise line and then you need to sell to individual consumers, you are losing those bulk sales. Not to mention Disney has way more money than I ever do as an individual wanting to buy tomatoes from my local grower. But again, you know, there are small growers that were equally impacted or medium-sized growers that were equally impacted by the pandemic and didn't have, you know, a Disney contract to fall on or an agency contract to fall on.
For the states that did this kind of thing, and again, you focused on Florida and Maine, is this something, are these electronic, these online farmers markets plan to stick around, or is this just like an emergency thing, we're done with it when we can be done with it?
Definitely plan to stick around. Like I mentioned, Maine already had theirs even before the pandemic, so it paid off for them preempting the supply chain disruption problems and seeing that work in an emergency. And in Florida, you know, the agriculture department there told me that they definitely plan on keeping the program around, and it's still functioning. You know, they did a revamp of it and changed kind of like how it looks and what you can show on it and do on it, and they hope to market it a bit more.
We're talking to Ximena Bustillo from Politico, agriculture and food policy reporter there. Ximena, I want to turn now to another story you're following. You mentioned the meatpacking industry earlier related to the pandemic. Well, there's a lot of big news going on right now surrounding the issue of concentration in the meatpacking industry. Fairly few companies processing meat. What do things look like now?
Yeah, for sure. This is definitely a really, really big topic right now. We hear about concentration and antitrust a lot for technology, but it is a prime issue for agriculture. For example, I guess in beef, four companies control about 80% of all meat, and they're actually dubbed the Big Four. So that's JBS, Tyson, National, and Cargill, probably household names that you've seen at the grocery store before. And because of the pandemic, you know, causing, again, that bottleneck clog and other recent events, like even JBS being hacked by Russian cyber criminals, that has really raised a lot of questions on Capitol Hill and at the White House about, you know, how safe is our food supply? How fragile is it? You know, is it good to have such few companies involved in our food system so heavily?
Is there a thought that even absent a pandemic or cybercrime or whatever, that having that kind of concentration is hurting? Well, let's start with consumers. Is there a thought that this might be making things, more expensive for us?
Yes, there is definitely a lot of conversation around pricing and price fixing. The Biden administration recently put out its own memo that kind of indicated that the price for meat in stores is increasing, but the revenue for ranchers isn't. So, and we heard that a lot today. I am actually calling you from the Hill, where going on hour four, the House Agriculture Committee is talking about the state of livestock in the United States. And that is something that has been brought up a lot by the lawmakers, as well as the witnesses, is, you know, are ranchers being paid for, you know, the meat they're producing at a way that is equivalent to what you or me are going to pay in the store?
Are you hearing members of Congress, apart from raising these questions, are we starting to hear policy ideas from them, breaking up big meat companies or what?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that has been talked about. A lot of it is up to the Department of Justice and the investigations that they undergo, but also with the Agriculture Department and ongoing programs that they are rolling out to kind of address that. And so you'll see that USDA over the last couple of months has begun announcing more programs to, for example, help fund small meatpacking facilities in some states, or implementing grants and loans and assistance to help new meat and poultry processors even enter the market to begin with. And, you know, earlier this week, USDA announced a new loan guarantee program to help what Tom Vilsack, the Ag Secretary, called the middle of supply chain. So if processors, like small or medium processors, wanted to invest more in cold storage or expand mobile processing or even marketing, they could do that. And a lot of this funding also comes from the COVID relief package that was passed in March by Congress. So you do see that legislation turning into a lot of these programs that the Agriculture Department is then able to roll out. But again, that was kind of COVID inspired.
I think all those things you just listed point toward incentives for smaller or medium-sized meat processors. Is there any stick, any things to punish the big groups or to limit their scope?
I haven't heard of anything that pointed yet. You know, the Biden administration says that they are, you know, looking into this, that they will, you know, do investigations as needed. I mean, even last fall, under a different administration, you saw the Justice Department going after JBS a little bit, or lawmakers wanted the Justice Department to go after JBS for consolidation attempts in Colorado. But, you know, it becomes a legal battle at that point.
Now, obviously, this is a big issue for ranchers, and I imagine representatives from places that raise a lot of meat. Is this seen as a big issue for consumers? We might notice the price go up some at the store. I have seen some reports that bacon supply may be limited. But is this something that, I don't know, politicians think their voters are going to get worked up over?
That's a really good question. I think it really depends on the region. You know, a bigger cattle state like Nebraska, for example, or a bigger processing state like Colorado, that might be more top of mind for people than in states where you don't have that proximity, for sure. I think, you know, going to the grocery store during the pandemic and seeing that you didn't have chicken on the shelves or that you didn't have beef on the shelves was shell shocking for a lot of folks. There was panic, right? Like, people were buying these items in bulk because they thought that there was a huge shortage. And again, it goes back to something that we said in the last segment, was the amount of cattle never went away, or the amount of beef never went away, but it was just the processing bottlenecks that were created when one processing plant was shut down because workers were sick, and now there's nowhere to process that beef or that chicken. So that did raise an alarm for a lot of folks. And I think it did create a bigger attention in areas where it might not necessarily be top of mind.
And Hyman, I know in the short term, you're going to go back and keep following this hearing. In the slightly less short term, what are you watching for next on this, just in our last half a minute?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this issue is ever evolving. The Biden administration has created its own competition council to address consolidation and competition in all sorts of sectors, but also agriculture. So kind of seeing how they utilize that council to advocate for different policy changes will be interesting, as well as, you know, what else does USDA do, or what else does the Justice Department kind of do as this conversation becomes top of mind and is honestly pretty bipartisan.
Ximena, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you again for having me.
That's Ximena Bustillo, food and agriculture policy reporter at Politico, with us today to talk about the Biden administration plans to turn around a concentration in the meatpacking industry and why many farmers turned to online sales during the pandemic. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, booster shots, a promising treatment pill, and more. We'll get the latest news on COVID-19 developments from a creator of the Dear Pandemic website. A Facebook whistleblower testified before Congress this week, providing, among other things, inside info about the ways the social media giant encourages the spread of misinformation. We'll look at the accusations and what it all means for what we see online. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with recipes inspired by the world of Hmong cuisine. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Sometimes we need to be willing to give people and things a second chance. And a music magazine did that this week. The magazine Pitchfork, which is for sure too cool for me, did an interesting experiment. They had some of their reviewers re-review albums they'd looked at in years past and update their reviews and scores. In many cases, they gave a higher score to the albums, sometimes with an apology to the artist for their initial snarky review. In others, they lowered their scores. The biggest jump was a Liz Phair album. It went up to 6 out of 10 from the original 0 out of 10. I am not on the cutting edge of music criticism, but it made me think about artists that I changed my mind about over the years. One that's on my list, 80s band Duran Duran. They are actually releasing a new album later this month. As a snarky junior high kid, I saw the Duran Duran posters popping up on lockers and thought, yeah, they're just kind of a pretty boy pop act, and I mocked them and their fans. Then I heard the song Rio and thought, well, this is a pretty good bass line. Nice chord progression, funky, kind of rocks, and a cool sax solo. Uh-oh. So I turned around on Duran Duran, and it was the start of a lesson slowly learned to not judge people for their musical tastes. Is there a band or performer that you did a 180 on? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. This is Central Time.